Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Today, it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Wendy B. King. Wendy B. King is a remarkable, compassionate human being, author, mother, and accomplished coach. She is transforming lives by drawing from her own experiences and extensive training with the Foundation in Metadynamics Coaching, which utilizes neuro-linguistic programming, or more commonly known as NLP, and emotional intimacy techniques acquired at Australia's premier coaching institution. She offers profound insights into the workings of the human mind. Wendy's journey is a testament to her resilience and strength. Having experienced the profound loss of a child, she understands the depths of despair and the arduous journey to healing. This personal experience has shaped her into the compassionate and insightful coach she is today. She has also demonstrated resilience by becoming Amazon's number one bestseller author of Why Me? How to Regain Hope After the Death of a Child, Your Own Survival Guide. In her book, she shares her story in part one and provides 12 lessons in part two on what happens to your brain, mind, body, nervous system, and more. It is a must-read for anyone seeking hope and healing. Today, she is a practicing life coach and is CEO of her own coaching business, Life is Beautiful Limited. She purposely named her business this to remind herself of the gift of life and that we have so much to be grateful for, even in our darkest moments. Wendy is a metadynamics coach and has received and gained her training at the Coaching Institute, Australia's number one coaching school. And with that, Wendy, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you, Dave. It's my pleasure to be here. And it's about changing lives, changing the world, making it a better place to live in, and to actually feel alive and embrace life, even in the darkest moments.
Absolutely. And I think together I have met not only individuals like yourself who are making a difference, whose sole purpose is to want to make a difference and improve the condition of the human experience just one life at a time. I think we're all in this together. And I think together we can make a difference in making the world a better place. We met through a mutual acquaintance, Portia Booker. Portia is a dynamic individual. She's had her own share of challenges and has a really great TV show, podcast. She's doing a lot of impactful work, and she just thought we would be a great match. And I think we had an hour and 20 minute pre-call, so we had a lot to talk about in the pre-call, and I think we hit it off really well. And we find ourselves here today discussing your journey and discussing what you've learned as a result of that and the current work that you're doing. So I'm anxious to get started and start asking you some questions.
Let's go.
All right, let's do it. First of all, Wendy, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions.
Okay, so I've had some big events in my life, and I'm probably going to work backwards a little bit because of where I am now compared to who I used to be. And so I'm 58 years of age, and pretty much 4 years ago, I had another big event happen in my life where I literally felt on my own abandoned, and the people that you think should have you back didn't. And it was a real big wake-up call for me in the sense that I realized I had less summers in front of me than behind me. And right up until that time, I felt like I was just getting through life and carrying the weight of my firstborn daughter who died at 5 months of age when I was 25 was a heaviness in my life because there was no support, no help. And it was a matter of, and because of the era my parents were born in, and their parents, wars of the parents, there was no emotional support because, as I've learned through my studies, is that we're emotional beings and we need to feel emotionally connected. And when we don't, we feel abandoned. However, people can't give what they don't have. And because my parents were emotionally shut down, when I needed actually support because of the death of my daughter, they couldn't support me because they didn't know how to. Okay. And so their way of dealing with it was just pray harder, it'll get better. And as time was going on, it wasn't getting better. In fact, I actually got worse and started to think there was something seriously wrong with me because I felt life so difficult to get through. Every day was like, I felt like I had a backpack of rocks on my back. And I was exhausted. I was exhausted all the time and I couldn't speak my daughter's name, Emma. Every time I heard a song that we had at the funeral, I'd be burst into tears. I literally withdrew from society or places where I felt that I could get triggered because literally I had never grieved. I'd never had death or anybody explain to me what was going on within my body. Because what happened was when my daughter died in the hospital, we got a phone call in at 4 o'clock in the morning saying, I'm sorry, your daughter's died, come in. That in itself was a trauma. And then when we left the hospital, we were given a pamphlet and said, here's the stages of grief, there you go. And so for most of my life, I thought there's something wrong with me. And when I had that moment in my life 4 years ago where I realized, you know what? The only person I'm relying on what I've been taught, what's been modeled, and what people are telling me. And nothing's working. So what am I going to do about it? So it was up to me to go, I'm sick of feeling like this. I was sick and tired of feeling sick and tired. I was sick and tired of not actually feeling, or it felt just an enormous sadness. And I wanted a change. And I have four beautiful children, yet I felt really disconnected from them. And part of that disconnection was because I was scared something was going to happen to them as well. Mm-hmm. Scared that I was still living on to the dream of I should have still had my daughter. And all the things that should have happened that didn't. Which really, as I'm just about going to go into your second question here, which, why was that so impactful? If I want to leave something with the listeners today, what would that be? It's one of the things that was a big wake-up call for me, it was a bit of a hard pill to swallow, was letting go of how life should be. Mm-hmm. What was also stopping me in my processing of my grief was that I was angry with watching the news, hearing of children being beaten, hurt. I was angry when I'd hear about women who could get pregnant and then aborting their babies. And I just wanted my baby. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed so unfair. And I was thinking about all the dreams. I'm not going to see her get married. I'm not going to see her do this. I'm not going to see her do that. And I was hanging on to that. And that was one of the biggest things that was keeping me stuck. Because guess what? We cannot control life. We cannot control life. And this is one of the big things we are just never really taught when we're growing up. We're taught what to learn and to be obedient and to be respectful and encouraged to get a good career. Mm-hmm. But we're not taught about relationships. We're not taught about how to be as a person. So that when we have a tragedy that happens in our life and we've had no one there that can actually emotionally support us, we feel completely lost. completely lost, and we just don't know what to do. And then when you do decide you're going to open up a little bit to somebody who goes, how are you really feeling? And the minute you actually go, I feel terrible. I just wish my daughter was here, and I miss this and I miss that. And if you get somebody that goes, oh, Wendy, you've just got to move on. Gosh, that happened 10 years ago, girl. It's just, there's got to be something wrong with me. I'm feeling this terrible pain and no one want to hear about it. And so there's something wrong with me. And so it got to a point where you don't want to hang around people, but you need to hang around people because you need that emotional connection. But you do it as a to protect yourself. Because you're like, I'm already suffering. I don't need you to put the knife in. But here's the thing is that they don't know how to be emotionally there for you because they can't handle their own emotion.
They can't handle their own grief, and they can't handle our grief. And essentially, they don't know how to be of support to somebody who's experienced a devastating loss. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to be. They don't know how to be present. Which is why a lot of grief coaches now and individuals who have transcended their own traumas are writing books about how to support somebody who's grieving. But as you mentioned, back in the day, 33 years ago, there weren't a lot of resources. How individuals saw grief was through Kubler-Ross's stages of grief. And Kubler-Ross's stages of grief were meant to give terminally ill individuals a vocabulary for the end-of-life chapter. It wasn't meant to be extrapolated to say this is how we grieve. Grief isn't a linear process. It's very much of a circular process. So if you're looking at the stages of grief, they don't go in steps. They're all jumbled. They're all over the place. Those emotions can be experienced at any time with varying intensity, depending on what's going on in your life, no matter how long it's been. And in many cases, the second year is more challenging than the first year because the reality of the second year hits us right between the eyes, and we realize that the first year wasn't a dream, that 1 year and 1 day after our children died, this was the life we were facing. We were facing a life moving forward without their presence, and it's like, how do we move forward? Do we want to move forward?
100%. At 100%. And that, as you say, your body is, and anybody listening here that has lost a child, please understand that that whole year, now we're talking about your body. Now, we're not just grieving, we've suffered a trauma because it's not, children are not supposed to die before their parent. It's just not supposed to happen. It has happened. So we have already, without even realizing it, when we have a child, we have gone, unconsciously we've gone, okay, we've got all these stages to look forward to, and then it's gone. And so it's now what do we do? And Dr. Basil van der Kolk, that a lot of people are familiar with his work, his book is The Body Keeps the Score, and he talks about the definition for trauma is the feeling that this pain is going to last forever. And he's also got an amazing podcast where he talks about it. And that is, anybody, if you feel flawed, you feel like there's something wrong with you, there is nothing wrong with you. It's when you get stuck in your grief and you don't know how to move on, there's still nothing wrong with you. You just need the right help and support. And a lot of people think, Wendy, I've done that. I've gone to the doctor and said, I need help. And the doctor wants to write me out a prescription. That's not what I want. And I had to go to the doctor because I had mild depression as well. But I also knew nobody could tell me or teach me what was going on. And that's what I decided 4 years ago. I needed to go, what is happening to my body? And again, this is what I want the viewers to think about, because there's a lot of people, and I never thought that I would feel the way I'm feeling now because of what I now know, have learned, and put into practice. And that is, you think, and I did for 31 years, feel like my life was over, like I was literally just going through the motions. I was not really existing. I was there in body, but not mentally. And knowing what the what's happening to your body and your mind and how to process things and how to look at the different aspects and to be, to, we have to go through a healing process. And it's like this. Think about this. When you have to have, if you have to have an operation, say you've got to have knee surgery, is you know you've got that pain, it's horrible, it's uncomfortable. You go to, the doctor refers you to a specialist. The specialist then tells you what he's going to do, what the recommendations are, and then gives you options. What do you want to do? But he also says, hey, we're going to do the surgery, but after the surgery, it might mean you're off work for 3 months. It might mean that you've got to do these exercises every day for a year. And then by then, you should be like, good as gold. Mm. We have doctors there that can take care of the physical ailment and give us the process, step by step, what we need to do. And we've actually got to go to the pain before we get better. I have not met one person yet who has been, who was able to tell me what was going to happen to my body, my mind, and that I needed to feel and heal and express myself. And actually, I had to go to the pain because I thought, and this is, goes back to what I knew as well, is that when I was 22 years of age, I was born in Scotland and my parents came to New Zealand, is that my grandmother had two children that died, one at 3 years of age of silent pneumonia and one who committed suicide. And so she was put into a mental institution. And when I was there, I went to visit her and she was doped up like this. And there was a woman around her dribbling. And I thought, oh my goodness. And of course I wasn't married. I didn't have children. So when I was feeling what I was feeling, I thought, I'm not going to go and tell a doctor I'm not coping because I'm going to end up in a place like that and I'm going to be doped up. That's not what I want. So I was hanging on to all this pain and no one there to say, hey, I'm there for you and this is what you're going to feel. This is what we need to do. This is what the body needs to do. Because if we don't release this pain that we have, we store it and it affects our nervous system.
And I think when you look at trauma, the body has a way of telling us where the trauma is settling. It can settle in our neck. It can settle in our back, even with our gait. And I think Bessel van der Kolk mentioned this in the book, that even our gait is affected. We walk slower. We walk like we're, I think, a little heavier. And that's because of the weight of trauma. And he also talked, this was a fascinating study that he did. He talked about the fact that sometimes people say that I don't have any words to describe what's going on because they're so traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially he discovered through his research, a part of the brain shuts down, the left side of the brain,
yep,
that is responsible for verbalization and also, you know, trying to make sense or conceptualize the trauma and express it to somebody in a verbal fashion. And that's BRCA's area, which is responsible for that type of language of trauma. That shuts down when the trauma becomes reenacted or we're in elevated levels of stress due to experiencing a life-altering event. So there's a scientific explanation in terms of how the brain operates for why people say that I don't have any words or they can't express verbally what's going on.
That's so true. And the other thing too that is frightens people is the stigma around showing grief or crying, and especially more so for men. And that is, we're biologically wired to feel our emotions. If the science, the facts are, people hear this, the facts are, the science is, that the way our brain operates is we feel, then we act, and then we think. Yep. And that starts right from when we're born. And it happens, you might not even be aware of it, but think of this, if you were standing at the stove and you had one of those plates that they've changed now where you used to, if you didn't realise the element was red, you would put your hand on it and pull away. But you don't actually put your hand on there and go, oh, it's hot, I need to pull my hand away. You don't. You automatically, your body automatically does it and you haven't even thought about it. It's an actual reaction. We are designed to feel and act before we think. It is a normal process. We need to understand that we have to educate ourselves. We have to educate ourselves and challenge what we've been told. Challenge what we've been told about our emotions. It's not good to cry. It's not good to do that. Or if you go there, you'll never get out. Guess what? When you meet the pain, when you do feel the emotion, it's like your body goes through a cycle. It's like a washing machine cycle. And you know what? Your body is actually getting rid of all the toxin, everything. It's getting, you are actually becoming at peace because you're allowing your body to repair itself, heal itself.
If we try to suppress that emotion, that's going to go inward. So we are best to express that emotion, get it out, release the toxins, and go through an emotional cleansing. And we learned that emotional expression can actually become an ally for us in grief. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, what would you like our listeners to know about your daughter, Emma?
Oh, gosh. She was born a prem baby. If you read my book, it will go into detail. Okay. And my book is designed for parents who need, it's like you're being heard. Okay. I wrote it specifically so that you could, it's not to feel the pain. It's so you feel understood and heard, and then also knows what's happening with the body. But what Emma taught me was how to love. Now this seems really bizarre, but again, I was brought up in a very strict home and there was very little emotional interaction. It was more about do this, do that. Again, it's not about blame. It's what my parents knew at the time. And all they wanted me to be was like decent citizens, which was literally being a little robot. Yes, dad, no dad. Yes, ma'am, no ma'am. No voice. No voice. And you only know what you know, right? So I was emotionally shut down and I didn't know I was emotionally shut down because I didn't have my emotions met. So at a very early age, I learned I wasn't allowed to cry. I wasn't allowed to get angry. I wasn't to ask for anything because I was told my parents were parents of the war. They at times didn't have enough to eat. They sometimes had to go without electricity. So in their mind, it was like, you've got a roof over your head, you've got food in your mouth, you've got clothes on your back, you're good. Good to go. Okay, you've got nothing to cry about, nothing to whine about. I really didn't know what love was because I wasn't told I was loved either. I just got told, don't do this or try harder. And that was just how I was raised. And so when I had Emma, when I saw this beautiful little bundle, I felt alive. I felt alive. And she was such a little fighter. And because of her condition, she was a one-off. So the doctor said to me, look, Wendy, there's a lot of prem babies that come through NICU who it takes them 2 years to catch up and then they're good as gold and they can go on and live a healthy life. Some may struggle and not be able to do a lot of sport. But because of Emma's condition, we can't say if she's going to live for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, like we really don't know. But here's the other thing that we do, and she taught me, is that because I felt this incredible love for her and was just absorbed by her, is that we unconsciously do this, is that, and we don't just do it with our children, we can do it with our job or a career. She was my purpose for living. So my life was about her. my life changed when I had her. And it was like, I've got a reason to live and feel alive and feel happy. And so when she died, it was like, what have I got to live for? And the thing that we have to really understand, and this is what I teach in my coaching and what I had to learn to accept, is that if we base our life on any one thing, whether it's our partner, our children, our job, financial status, our friendships, if we have all these external things that have to make up how we feel, we're setting ourselves up for disaster. Because if any of that, we lose any of those things, it's now what do we do? We've based our reason for living, who we are as a person, on those things to fill a hole, to define who we are. We need to know who we are and that we are lovable, we're good enough. We know our soul, we know our purpose, and our husband, our work, our finances, our children are an enhancement of that. But they can't be what we live for, because the moment we make those things the reason why we live, the moment they're gone, we crash. And that's what happened to me, is I crashed. And again, I didn't realize what I was doing, but I based my happiness, my purpose, on my daughter. And then I knew that when I went to have children, that they wouldn't replace her. But I still based my happiness on my children, but I was also terrified of losing them, because I'd already gone through loss and I was living in fear on a daily basis. Thinking of, what if I get another phone call and say one of them's been hit by a car? What if I get another phone call too? What if they get sick and they die? So we have to be, it's a time to really reflect. Who are we? What are we using to get us through life, instead of being, who are we? And when I realized, so here's the thing, is when I started writing my book, my mantra was, the hardest part wasn't losing you, the hardest part was living without you. And that I was just sadness city. When I started writing my book and I got to the third manuscript and I was going through it again, and already what I'd been learning about the brain and the nervous system and how we need to be as a person, and that everything affects the whole of us, not just the brain, not just our physical, it's everything affects us. We are all wired to connect. Our whole body's connected, our mind, everything is connected. And when I was on the third manuscript and I got to the last chapter, and I thought, and I was struggling a little bit, and I thought, why am I writing this book again? Like, why am I writing this book? And it was like, I'm writing this book because I want to help so many parents who have nowhere to go to, who don't feel understood, who don't feel heard. It's like building a plane where the Orville brothers, the Wright brothers rather, were laughed at, scoffed at, who's going to fly a plane? And then it happens. And then me going, guess what? You can get yourself out of this pain. So I wanted to help other parents and know what was going on with inside them. But the other thing was, it just came to me, it was like, because I'm living for you, not dying because of you. I've stopped dying. Like I literally had a light bulb moment going, I don't know if I'm going to see Emma again. I don't know if there's an afterlife. I don't know. Okay. But What if she could see me, and what if she said to me, "Mama, why did you live your life crying and sad? Why did you not live life so that when we saw each other again, you could tell me everything about it? Why, Mama? Why did you give up?" And that was a light bulb moment for me. It was like, I'm going to live for you, not die because of you, because I've been dying for the last 30 years inside. And so I, you know, this is just one little part that has just fired me up. And out of a whole lot of things that have helped me with the grieving, the trauma, and I feel like I'm not carrying this massive weight and this big cloud of, I don't want to be seen, I want to hide. I've gone from that to go, I've got this love to give, and I want the world to know they can feel alive. I want to hear the grotty days. I want to hear your sadness because I can cope with it. Because I know if you want to, we can do this together.
And I think when, for me, it's been 21 plus years since my daughter, Janine, and I call it transition to from the physical plane to the spiritual plane. And again, other people will conceptualize it as dying or passing away. But 21 years later, I am not only honoring her, living for her, I'm living with her. She's very much a part of what I do. And I also hear you say, did the same thing with Emma, and you're living with who the person you envisioned her to become had she had grown, living with those characteristics ingrained in you.
Yeah.
And what it is, it's a message of love. It's a message of hope. And I think in later grief, it becomes about service while we still honor the grief process, understand that we're still going to grieve because our grief is an ongoing, continued grief, in though it becomes manageable, is still an ongoing sign of the love that we still carry for the children that we've lost. And later in grief, I learned that grief isn't something to be feared. It's something to be honored because it is an expression of the ongoing love that we have for those children or loved ones who we've lost. And that's all part of the metamorphosis or transformation that we go through as we continue to work through grief. So those are the biggest differences I've seen, at least in my journey. And I think I hear some alignment in terms of what you've gone through in 33 plus years with Emma.
Yeah. And it is the hardest thing you will ever experience. In fact, and it's in my book, but it was about 4 days after Emma died, I developed this pain in my heart and I ended up going to the doctor because it was so severe. And it was just like just taking a little breath like that. It was excruciating. And I was diagnosed with broken heart syndrome, Takotsubo. And that is, people can die of it. And that's when you see couples that have been married for a long time and one dies and the other one, what's my purpose? They die. And it's literally they've died of broken heart. Well, I had that for 4.5 months. And I also had, on top of that, nightmares because she died in the hospital. I kept having these dreams that somebody had stolen her, taken her away. And it got to a point I thought I was going to be mentally challenged for the rest of my days. And it was so painful. I never planned it, but I thought, I don't want to be here. I wanted to go. I had nothing to live for. I wanted to die. And I would actually pray to God at night to say, please take me. And if some other young person's going to die, take me instead of them. It was just, I was like bargaining with God going, please just end it for me. I can't deal with it anymore. And please just end it. I can't do this. And so there is severe pain and grief. And your mind goes crazy. It's when you get stuck. And like you said, that first year, you honestly, it's like you hang on to, when I had those nightmares, it was like someone, even though I went in the hospital and I held her and she wasn't breathing. And it was like, somebody tricked me and they're going to knock on my door and say, she actually got stolen. She got switched with another baby that looked like your baby, and here she is. It's crazy what your mind does. But it's it was also like when you the child is older, you think they're going to walk through the door. People I've dealt with, it's just so hard to let go that they're not there. But it's actually then you never, ever stop thinking, feeling about your child. It's how you live without them. Being physically here, that's it.
And how we learn to live without them becomes part of our life narrative that gets redefined. And that's what we talk about integration of grief. It's learning how can we live without their physical presence, but yet carry the essence of who they are or who they would be within our hearts, within our soul, and carry that message together in unison with our child, carry that message together to other individuals to spread again that message of hope. And you mentioned broken heart syndrome. I was reading about that recently, and I was reading that it affects women more than it does men. And I think it's where the left ventricle of the heart, which is responsible, I think, for pumping most of the blood flow to our heart, I think, weakened. And
yeah, it does.
It causes some issues. It isn't, like you said, it could be fatal, but it isn't necessarily fatal. But it's treatable if it's picked up early enough. And I'm glad they picked it up early enough for you.
Yeah, it was literally like you were aware of it the whole time. It was like somebody having their hand inside your body, squeezing your heart like this. So every time you took a breath, it was like when you walked, it was just intense pain. And I was sure that I was going to, I was sure that I was scared to run because I thought, nah, that will kill me. And it's like, you don't want to die. You just want the pain. You just want that excruciating pain to stop. Mm-hmm. That's all you want, is that excruciating pain to stop.
And for me, I was never suicidal. But if God told me, hey, we're going to take your life today, the day or a week after my daughter Janine transitioned, I would have been okay with that. I would have said, fine, let eternity start now. But the universe or God had, I think, more of a grand plan. It was not my time. And sometimes one day I'll question why I was given the privilege to grow older. I'll look at that, particularly when my child died before her time, your child died before she had a chance to really experience life. And so I'll ask myself that question, but I don't stay there for that long because it's a question I'm not going to be able to answer until I go to the next dimension and ask that question of whoever, if it's God or a spirit guide, why was I allowed to grow older? I know I had a greater purpose, obviously, after Janine transitioned, but it's like, still, why was I chosen? Why wasn't it my daughter that could have honored my legacy as opposed to me creating a legacy for her? You know, but that question will remain unanswered. And also in later grief, I've learned to live with the ambiguity and live with unanswered questions, realizing that there just isn't any human law explanation for many of the questions that we have. So,
yeah.
The second part of your book is dedicated to the 12 lessons of healing. How did you come up with those lessons, and why do you feel they're crucial to helping individuals get through grief?
It's quite simple, really, is that when I had that moment of, I have to challenge what I know that I've been taught, okay? It's up to me to, if I want to have a quality of life and find out what's wrong with me, I can sit back and go, that's just how it is, because I'd been told that's just how it was for the last 30 odd years. And I wasn't satisfied with that any longer. I just wasn't satisfied with that. So I thought the first thing I've got to do is, I knew I was emotionally shut down. So I wanted to know, what were our emotions and why did we have them and what do they mean? When I'm saying it out loud now, it just seems quite bizarre for me to say this, but honestly, we just never taught. I know they're starting to bring this into schools, like about emotions. Mm-hmm. I was literally so numbed out that I was to cope, that I was so disassociated that I had to learn how to feel Like, I couldn't actually cry anymore. If I laughed, I used to put on this fake laugh that I didn't really laugh very much either. I was just this pan-faced person. Or if I had to go to an event where I was expected to be happy, like a wedding or engagement, I would literally have to psych myself up and stand in front of the mirror and go like this, because inside I could not feel it. So when I started learning about emotions, then I started learning about what happens to the body. And then when I started learning about the body, I wanted to learn what happens about the brain. And then when I started learning about the brain, I started learning about the nervous system. And then I learned about the nervous system, and then learned about also the big vagus nerve that we have, that this is the mind-body connection that we, again, I think is crucial to be taught in school. I can't understand why it's not even in biology, because it helps you understand your mind-body connection, that everybody has that gut feeling, that pit in their stomach, and that comes from the vagus nerve. And that, they call the gut now like the second brain, because when you know something's off, it's off. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible how the vagus nerve, the bottom of your brain stem, goes to all your major organs, and it is part of the nervous system, so that when you learn about breathing to calm the nervous system down, why that works. Like, I used to think it was a lot of Jimbo, weary, fluffy stuff that people were making up, until I realized, no, this is actually what happens when you concentrate on your breath. This is what it does to your heart. This is what it does to your organ. Mm-hmm. And it's, wow. Then it also took me into, when I was learning about the brain, it was like during childhood, the way we are raised affects how we process our emotions or not in our adulthood. And if we were never to express emotions when we were little, we cannot express them when they're older. And our emotions are also help us be vulnerable and connect with people. And we are designed to connect with people. And here's the thing, is that how many relationships split up because we can't communicate how we are feeling? We just end up going, you make me mad. You do this. You're so annoying. We're attacking people. We can't actually go, hey, I don't know if you're aware, but when you're doing so-and-so, that it may not be a big deal to you, and you might not even be aware you're doing it, but when you do, this is how it makes me feel. And because it reminds me of whatever. Now, that might sound silly to you, but do you mind not doing that? Because it really just reminds me of this. Now, your partner could go, gee, I didn't even know I was, no, come here, babe, I'll give you a hug. But how many people scream and yell and go, your husband says, what's wrong with you? Fine, fine. Everybody can laugh and giggle because we're not fine. We're actually saying we're so angry, but we can't verbalize what we just can't find the words, because as you're saying again, that part of the brain hasn't been developed to say, this is how I'm feeling. We have to relearn so much stuff that we never got taught in childhood.
Early experience does matter. And I was listening to your early childhood experience, and it seemed like you were in a situation where, you know, it was your parents' way or no way. Emotions weren't allowed to be expressed. And you take, if the narrative isn't changed in early childhood, you're going to take that into your adult relationships. You're going to take that, and it's going to, I think, impact how you grieve. And when you start experiencing emotions that you were not allowed to experience before, you start questioning your sanity because it's something that you weren't allowed to experience, and now you are. So what do I do with it? And if you weren't taught that emotions are a normal part of growth, they're a normal part of how we work through things, and they're healthy to express emotions in ways that will be supported, then it becomes like, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? I haven't experienced this before. Is something off?
Absolutely. And here's the thing about emotions. And this is where people get confused, and especially about anger, is that when you're feeling an emotion, and if, try this on, depending on where you are, of course, because if you're in the supermarket, it might not be the most appropriate place, but is if you can't deal, if something's triggered you at the supermarket, just say, is when you get home, make sure you attend to that emotion. So if somebody got angry with you and they were just having a bad day, you go home and you're thinking, I'm really upset because that idiot shouldn't have got upset, but now I'm upset. Sit with the emotion. Feel the emotion. Just feel the emotion and go, I'm allowed to feel this way. I'm upset. And just sit with it and let it process it. It seems so simple, but it really is. Because when you acknowledge what is going on in your body, if anybody's going, oh, that sounds stupid, Wendy. If you've got a toothache, you're going to feel your toothache and then you're going to do something about it. Your emotions are the same as you feel your emotions and they will leave your body. People get confused because they think they have to act out on your emotion. That's what's wrong, is you don't have to act on your emotions. It's called feeling it. When you feel it, you process it and it leaves the body. Mm-hmm. You don't get taught that.
Your book is great too. For those of you who are going to watch this on YouTube, you'll see Wendy has a Pulse River book, Why Me? How to Regain Hope After the Death of a Child. And there's one passage, it was on page 96 of your book. You wrote that the major requirement of the journey is a willingness to let go of the attachment to your current experience of life. And when I looked at that, that is just so profound, because in order for us to move forward, we have to release any expectations of what our life was like before, because that isn't the life we're going to lead now. Once we release that and we understand that it isn't, then we can rebuild the foundation of our beliefs, of our values, of our priorities, and move forward with renewed purpose. But if we attach to that what we think life should be, and we feel robbed of that current experience, we're not going to move forward.
100%. That is exactly correct. And that's what keeps so many of us stuck, because we feel betrayed. We feel grieved. We feel, why me? That's why I called it why me, because we start thinking that we're being punished, or why do bad things happen to good people? We're doing this reasoning in our head and all the bartering, and we start saying this shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have happened. Or here's the thing. How is it fear that if you were born in Afghanistan, that a husband just thinks you're having an affair and he can throw acid on your face, or your son can kill you? Or how is it fair that you live in Lebanon or Syria and you don't know if your family's going to come home that night or not? We have to accept, we don't have to, because this is where you get stuck, is go, it shouldn't have happened to me. We can't control life. And the biggest thing as well is because when we're very little, we read books about she grew up and she married the prince, or he was a frog and he turned into a prince. So we have this idea that we can change men if they're bad. We're going to have children and we're going to get married and this will happen and that happen. And so we have this story. How many girls start thinking about the day they get married when they're 4 or 5? They have this idea, and when it doesn't work out, they're like, my life is over. Like, my life is over. So we have to let go of these stories, these attachments that we have about how life should be. The most important day is today, because honestly, I don't know. I could walk out on this across the street tomorrow and a truck could kill me. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to retire. I want to get old and die. But guess what? I don't have control over that. I don't have control over that. And as soon as you wake up and go, guess what? I don't have control over that. The minute you can let go of all that stuff, you actually go, what will be? Mm-hmm. Because you can't control it. And when you know and accept you can't control it, guess what? You stop living in fear of it happening.
Yep.
You stop living in fear. And do you know how much peace we lose because we live in fear?
Yeah, how many missed opportunities, how much peace we lose. And essentially, fear is debilitating. And typically, what we fear is going to resurface.
100%, yes.
Wendy, my final question for you, and we can go on probably for another hour. But my final question for you is, if individuals want to get in touch with you, contract with you for your services, purchase your book, what is the best way for them to do all of that?
Okay, so I have a website, and it's called Wendy B. King LifeCoaching.com. There is a link to my services and my book, and you can now get my book in an audible version. So if you really just cannot pick up the book and go, it'll give you a link. It's not audible as in the app Audible. It's all sound, but the link is there because I'm not a Canadian, Australian, or American or UK citizen. I couldn't upload it there, but I have another platform, and you can usually access that to anybody. So I have also got free PDFs that people can download about our emotion. So if they want our emotions, Heal to Feel is another one. Another one is just general grief, mm-hmm. and the different types of grief. Like people can, an animal, our beloved pet, we can still feel so upset about our pet. So these are free downloadables that you can go to my website. Also on my Facebook, which is Wendy B. King. What I'm also developing, and if people want to support me or say, go for it, Wendy, is I want to create I've decided that there's a lot of people out there, they need a place they can go to. So I'm thinking of creating a Facebook group for people that have lost a child. And it's where we can laugh, cry, be heard, and I can also give some life. I can literally give you some mentoring or coaching. Because here's the thing, is that, and I'm glad I remembered it, is that when we're grieving so badly, is that we sometimes expect our nearest and dearest to be there to support us. But guess what? Our partner can be experiencing so much pain themselves, or our immediate family are just coping with you being so upset that they can't actually cope with you and help you. So you need, it's not that they don't want to, they just don't know how to. And sometimes they can say things that make you feel worse than better. So you need a community or a group that understands you. I'm going to set that up. And if it's one people, 10 people, whatever it turns into, but you don't have to do it alone.
No, and with every new loss that we experience, we go through the process again. We go right from the beginning, and we need to. It's meant to be. It's meant to be felt. It's meant to be experienced in its own unique way with every loss that we experience.
Yeah, and there's no shame.
No.
There's no shame.
No. It's a part of the human condition. If we live long enough, we're going to experience loss. And even once we experience the worst, what we believe is the worst loss of our lives, if we grow older, we're going to experience more loss. So it's something that we need to learn to continually adapt to understand, and in some strange way, make friends with in order to move through it. So,
yeah.
But with that, Wendy, thank you so much for spending time with me and our listeners tonight. I truly enjoyed our conversation. I hope we can do this again sometime.
I'd love to. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. That is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.